Coming up is the news.
Top stories. Saudi Arabia intensify its airstrikes on the Yemeni capital Sana'a, hitting a stadium and an area near a hospital in its latest attacks. At least 25 Palestinians are injured after Israeli forces and settlers attack a village in the occupied West Bank. Also ahead, South Korea grants a special pardon to former President Park Geun-hye, who was serving a jail term of 22 years for corruption. Our top story, Saudi warplanes once again pound the Yemeni capital Sana'a as the kingdom intensifies its airstrikes on the country. Saudi jets bombed a number of residential areas. One of the attacks hit a venue near a hospital, leaving at least one civilian injured. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has rejected Riyadh's claim that the site was a weapons depot. Saudi fighter jets also hit a sports complex in northern Sana'a. In reaction, Yemen's Olympic Committee called on international bodies to put an end to Saudi attacks against sports facilities. Riyadh has recently stepped up its aggression on Yemen. The Saudi war on the country began in 2015 and has left thousands and thousands of Yemenis dead. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has given us the latest details on Saudi Arabia's airstrikes on the Yemeni capital.
It's the place where I live. They were a few meters away from my house. We've heard them actually at the night at 10 and or 2 and 10 minutes p.m. or a.m. I'm sorry. We heard the bombardment. The windows broke. The tank of water broke. They targeted only a residential area, and it is very populated. There are a lot of people. I walked down to the street last night, and so the aftermath of the bombardment, the people there were very angry, as it is a very crowded area. There are thousands of people in that street. It's in the heart of the city of Sana'a. It's called the Zubairi Street, and all the world, all the Yemenis, I mean, know that this place or this area is a very populated area. So it was against the international law that protects civilian areas and civilian facilities. There were a civilian injured in that attack, and I believe that he is on the hospital now. Maybe he will live, maybe he will die. Most of the injuries, they die after a day or two when they go to the hospital.
The Palestine Red Crescent Society says Israeli settlers and troops have attacked a Palestinian village in the occupied West Bank, injuring at least 125 people. The injured were targeted by rubber bullets and tear gas fired by the regime forces. The troops attacked villagers living near the site of a former Israeli settlement in the northern West Bank. The settlement was destroyed by the Israeli military in 2005. Now the settlers say they want to return. Thousands of them attacked the Palestinian village while backed by Israeli forces. Settlers frequently attack Palestinians in various parts of the West Bank. Israeli rights group Beit Salem says it has documented over 450 such incidents since early 2020. The group says the Israeli forces did not intervene to stop the attacks in the majority of cases and often actively joined in. Let's find out the latest on that story through the help of Mona Kandil, our correspondent, who joins us live via Skype out of Ramallah. Mona, over to you.
Well, what happened last night is that over 1,000 Israeli settlers returned to the evacuated settlement of Homish that is built between Nablus and Jenin near the Palestinian village of Burqa. Last week, an Israeli settler was killed in an ambush. There were a group of settlers at the Homish Yeshiva, which is a religious school. And when they were leaving the school from the settlement of Homish, there was an ambush and an Israeli settler was killed. So the Israeli settlers were very angry and they are demanding to return to this evacuated settlement. As you have mentioned, it was evacuated in 2005. However, some buildings are still there and they are not, they had not been destroyed. The Israeli army decided yesterday to return to Homish and destroy all the buildings there, even the Jewish seminary. However, the settlers returned. They're trying to prevent the demolition and at the same time attacked the residents of Burqa with the protection of the Israeli military, because of course the Israeli soldiers would be protecting the settlers and not the Palestinians, even if they would be attacked, fired at by the settlers. 125 Palestinians have been wounded during these clashes, while Palestinians had been trying to prevent the settlers from attacking them, to prevent the settlers from seizing more land there. The majority of those Palestinians, according to reports from Palestinian paramedics, had been wounded with rubber-coated bullets and others suffocated due to inhaling tear gas. The settlers are demanding the Israeli regime, instead of destroying the buildings in the Homish settlement, they must allow the settlers to return back to this evacuated settlement, because they are saying that the Palestinians are trying to terrify the settlers by killing one Israeli settler in order to force settlers leave other settlements, but they insist to stay there and insist not to allow Palestinians regain back their lands that illegal settlements are built on.
Many, many thanks for that update. That's Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah. Iran's foreign minister says his country will, in a serious manner, continue talks with the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal, also known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, at the same time, criticizes the European parties for taking an unconstructive approach in the talks. Take a listen.
The other parties are continuously doing interviews, saying that they are worried about the progress of Iran's nuclear program. We announce it loudly that if you want to alleviate your concerns about Iran's peaceful nuclear program, all JCPOA-related sanctions against Iran must be removed. The Islamic Republic of Iran will continue its strong talks in a logical manner until a good deal is reached. On the whole, we did not see the position of some European countries as very constructive, specifically that of France. In the latest round of talks, the three European countries practically presented no new initiatives.
Amir Abdullahian also said Iran rejects this approach, that the other parties offer one concession to get several ones in return. Tehran and the remaining JCPOA members have held seven rounds of talks in Vienna this year to resolve outstanding issues over the 2015 deal. Those issues began after the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In response, Tehran rolled back its commitments a year later. Iran says it'll fully meet its obligations only after the U.S. removes the sanctions. Vienna will host a new round of negotiations by the JCPOA members next week. International lawyer and peace activist John Philpott says the U.S. must pay reparations to Iran for violating the 2015 deal.
I noticed Britain saying time's running out for Iran. Well, is it not the U.S. who's in the wrong? Iran is not in the wrong. Iran maintained its commitments for quite a while. I don't know the number of months, but a year or two. after they allowed inspections and did not start to enrich uranium. I don't know a lot about uranium other than what I read, but they respected the agreement even though they didn't have to, because U.S. withdrawing, they're no longer bound. Now, Iran is trying to resolve this sanctions issue. I'm a member of Sanctions Kill. Sanctions do kill, and sanctions are illegal in international law. I think the U.S. has to pay reparations, personally. I'm not in power, but U.S. should be paying reparations to Iran for these illegal sanctions.
A senior Iranian military commander says the ground forces of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps is displaying its latest accomplishments during the large-scale war games that are underway in the south of the country.
The drills featured massive artillery fire as well as operations by the amphibious operations unit of the IRGC ground force. As you saw today, the exercises involved divers as well as large numbers of vessels taking combat troops to the shore, which was among the most important achievements of the IRGC ground force. This has enabled the force to couple its defense operations with combat tactics.
The IRGC forces wrapped up the ground phase by conducting extensive drills overnight. They rehearsed a combination of tactics using artillery and armored units, attack helicopters and drones. Maneuvers have been ongoing in the Persian Gulf region, the Strait of Hormuz, as well as the coasts of Hormozgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The exercises, codenamed the Great Prophet 17, are part of military drills Iran holds regularly to improve its combat power. The five-day maneuvers will end on Friday. Welcome to this hour's On the News Line. The U.S. has used the language of threat against Iran once again. A familiar and outdated phrase called other options, used interchangeably with all options, but many analysts argue that a look at Iran's massive military exercises involving new weaponry equipment and modern techniques should make the U.S. think twice before making a military threat.
The United States has stepped up its anti-Iran rhetoric, threatening Iran with, quote, other options if negotiations in the Austrian capital fail to restore the 2015 agreements. The threatening language was made by the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley. He warned of a period of escalating crisis if diplomacy failed to restore the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. The remarks came days after negotiators from Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA concluded the seventh round of talks in Vienna, aimed at bringing the U.S. back into compliance with the agreement by removing its sanctions against Iran. Malley referred to Iran's retaliatory measures within the JCPOA framework and said, if they continue at their current pace, we have some weeks left to restore the 2015 deal, but not much more than that, at which point the conclusion will be that there is no deal to be revived. Meanwhile, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said the window is rapidly closing to save 2015 agreements and that Washington is exploring other options.
U.S. government is very much aware of this fact that the U.S. Army, the broad masses of Americans, don't want another war. We have just gotten out of Afghanistan after 20 years. Finally, things are perhaps coming to a close in Iraq as well, and so to, you know, within under a year, go back into Eurasia, go back into also the Arab world, and start another war would be absolutely disastrous.
Blinken claimed Iran's nuclear advances are making it increasingly problematic to return to the 2015 agreement. It is getting very, very, very short, being able to recover the full benefits of the JCPOA, but returning to compliance with it is getting increasingly problematic by the advances that Iran makes every single day in its nuclear program. This is while the Vienna talks have taken a break after Iran and the IAEA reached an agreement for the agency to install its cameras at the Karaj nuclear facility, a point insisted by the parties to the talk. Iran also agreed to this as a goodwill gesture. Anthony Blinken also blamed the former administration of Donald Trump for the worst decision made in American foreign policy in the last decade by withdrawing from the deal in 2018.
To another one of our headline stories, South Korea's president grants a pardon to his predecessor who is serving a lengthy prison term for corruption.
As of December 31st, 2021, the government will grant a special pardon to a total of 3,094 people. We have included former President Park Geun-hye and former Prime Minister Han Myung-suk to the list to overcome unfortunate past history and the crisis of COVID-19, realize people's unity, and provide a chance to take a new step forward to the future.
The pardon cuts short a jail term for more than 20 years for the ex-president. Incumbent President Moon Jae-in had previously ruled out a pardon. Moon, however, says the deteriorating health of his predecessor was a factor in his U-turn. Former President Park Geun-hye has been hospitalized several times this year and is currently receiving treatment. She was arrested in 2017 after being removed from office following a corruption scandal. A year later, the 69-year-old was convicted of abuse of power and bribery. Japan says no state official will visit Beijing for the Winter Olympics. It comes after the United States and a few other Western countries imposed diplomatic boycotts on the Games. Japan's government spokesman blamed China's human rights record for Tokyo's decision. Hirokazu Matsuno says Japan will be represented in the Games only by its Olympic and Paralympic officials. Earlier this month, the U.S., Britain, Australia, and Canada announced diplomatic boycotts of the Beijing Games over China's alleged violation of human rights. Beijing has warned that four countries will pay the price for the U.S.-led campaign. And that's it with international news.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت القرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 كتاب الله. Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful, Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left you last week, and today we will complete the explanation of Surah Zariyat. Here are ayahs 54
and 55.
So turn away from them, for you will not be blameworthy. And admonish, for admonishment indeed benefits the faithful. If you remember, last Friday in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said the insults hurled by the misled should not dampen us or stop us from carrying out our mission, since from time immemorial tyrants and wrongdoers have always opposed the truth. It is actually lack of faith and satanic tendencies that make disbelievers ridicule prophets, imams, and saints. The ayahs that we recited to you now tell the Prophet of Islam and the believers to turn away from disobedient disbelievers, since you have fulfilled your mission of guidance and carry no blame concerning discharge your duties. Ayah 55, however, commands the Prophet that irrespective of the disbelievers' obstinacy or their unfounded accusations against him, he should continue to admonish, since admonition strengthens the faith of the believers in view of the fact that it is a reminder of God's favors. Admonishment is also a warning against the consequences of disobedience and holds out hope of guiding people towards divine mercy of the all-forgiving Lord. These ayahs teach us that, number one, prophets are duty-bound to proclaim the divine message to the public, but don't carry any blame if the intransigent disbelievers do not respond to their invitation towards monotheism and virtue by refusing to believe. Number two, we should not expect all people to believe, but should strive to the best of our ability with earnest hope that many will believe. And number three, among the characteristics of the believers is to heed admonishment. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 56, 57 and 58 of the same surah.
وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسَ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ مَا أُرِيدُ مِنْهُمْ مِنْ رِزْقٍ وَمَا أُرِيدُ أَنْ يُطْعِمُونَ إن الله هو الرزاق ذو القوة المتين.
I did not create the jinn and the humans except that they may worship me. I desire no provision from them, nor do I desire that they should feed me. Indeed, it is Allah who is the all provider, powerful, all strong. Here the Almighty Creator says the goal of creation should never be ignored by the creatures, since nothing has been created in vain, and the purpose of creating the human race and the invisible species called jinn, by granting them the gift of the intellect and speech, is that they should solely worship Him. In other words, the actual meaning of worship is not just the performance of rituals or a few prescribed formal prayers recited by the mouth. Real worship means surrender of the ego, self-control, and discipline, so that we act only in consonance with the expressed will of Allah, as was practically shown by the prophets, the imams, and the virtuous religious scholars. The Prophet 16th Infallible Heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, has said, Allah created mankind and granted the faculties of the observation and the contemplation so as to acquire knowledge with which man understands the manifestation of divine power and then submits to Him. The ayahs that follow, that is 57 and 58, mean to say that one may not imagine that the Almighty Creator is in need of the worship and deeds of jinn and mankind. As a matter of fact, Allah the Exalted is neither in need of provision nor food, since He is the needless and all creatures are in need of Him. He is the absolute provider, the omnipotent, and the omniscient. All creatures are in need of His grandeur and lordship while He is needless of everything, which means our worshipping of God is to our own benefit. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the purpose of creation is not in vain, and the lofty goal is the correct way of worshipping the Almighty Creator, which is not limited to performance of rituals, but requires proper cognizance and wholehearted submission to divine will by creatures bestowed with the gift of the intellect and the power of speech, such as mankind and the invisible species called the jinn. Number two, Allah the Exalted is not in need of our worship, rather, it is we who need to worship Him in the proper way for our own benefit, in order to attain perfection and the rewards which He has reserved for the believers. And number three, we should strive to earn our livelihood, but should not forget that the source of our sustenance is the Almighty Creator. Now, in conclusion of this week's episode, let us listen to ayahs 59 and 60 that mark the end of Surah Zariyat as well.
فَإِنَّ لِلَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا ذَنُوبًا مِثْلَ ذَنُوبِ أَصْحَابِهِمْ فَلَا يَسْتَعْجِلُونَ فَوَيْلٌ لِلَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا مِنْ يَوْمِهِمُ الَّذِي يُوعَدُونَ.
So indeed, the lot of those who do wrong now will be like the lot of their earlier counterparts. So let them not ask me to hasten on that fate. Woe to the faithless for the day they are promised. These ayahs, which sum up the contents of the surah, including the accounts of the afflictions that befell the disobedient nations of the past, mean to say that those who do not worship the one and only Creator and indulge in disbelief, atheism, and polytheism, by refusing to tread the path and purpose of creation, are sinners similar to their sinful predecessors. In answer to the disbelievers' derisive question as to the time of the divine torment to be sent down upon them, these ayahs address them, saying, "The time of your punishment shall arrive, and you need not hasten, for it will indeed woefully strike you as promised." From these ayahs we learn that, number one, disobedience of divine commandments is to one's own doom and eternal damnation. Number two, divine mercy and divine wrath are based on the Almighty's Creator's infinite knowledge and wisdom, which means the rashness and irrationality of the disbelievers have no effect on the time of His decision. And number three, our fate depends on our deeds, whether good or bad, the consequences of which are reward and punishment.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Freedom seems to continue to be more and more limited in a country like Britain. A Conservative MP says the British government will make it illegal to participate in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement next year. Now, this basically means that, similar to many of their American cousins, Brits will not be free to choose to boycott the racist apartheid entity of Israel in the same way the global civil community was able to boycott and pressure the former apartheid regime in South Africa until it fell. What does it all mean for freedom of choice in countries which profess to believe in democracy but show themselves to be quite authoritarian, especially when it comes to Israel?
Alarm bells have rung across Britain after a Conservative MP informed pro-Israel activists of new government plans to outlaw the pro-Palestine boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. The comments were said by British lawmaker Robert Jenrick during an online conference about anti-Semitism titled "Why Do So Many People Hate Jews?"
it is, I think, becoming much more of a fringe activity. What we want to do is pass a piece of legislation here, and I'm pretty confident it will be in the next legislative programme, the Queen's Speech, as we call it.
Since 2005, the boycott campaign, also known as BDS, has sought to sanction all Israeli-made products produced on illegally occupied Palestinian lands. The movement has been so successful in causing economic damage to Israel that pro-Israel groups have branded the BDS an existential threat and attempted to smear its supporters as anti-Semitic.
It's a shocking decision from the humanitarian point of view, where once again the British government is standing by the oppressor, is standing by the occupier, is standing by the criminal against the victim. It's something that it doesn't surprise, but it shocks as to the how tone deaf this government is. I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that if anything, this government has stupidly, foolishly, ridiculously, has actually afforded far more credit to BDS than it could ever have imagined.
This development would be just the latest example of a long line of attacks that this government has carried out against Palestine solidarity activism since it came into power. If they go ahead with these plans next year, then we can expect to see large-scale protest and condemnation action taking place from the many supporters of the Palestinian cause up and down the country. Robert Carter, London.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mostafa out of London. And lawyer and BDS campaigner Blaine Coleman out of Ann Arbor, Michigan.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, welcome both of you to the program. I'd like to start off with Hafsa. I mean, the conservative MP exposed plans by the government during an online conference that they would be making it illegal to participate in the BDS. I mean, what is your perspective about this if it really happens?
It's difficult to say. I don't think in practice it will impact the act of boycotting Israeli goods and events, because obviously people are entirely free to carry out those boycotts, and they are free to refuse to purchase goods that were produced illegally and in a country that violates human rights law and oppresses the Palestinian people. However, I think it's the act of promoting those boycotts that becomes illegal and therefore becomes problematic, because of course pro-Palestinian organizations are reliant on this technique, and in order first to promote the Palestinian cause and also to push for more rights for Palestinians through peaceful means. Now, of course, many of us have been saying that we shouldn't have been putting all our eggs in the same basket by concentrating exclusively on BDS, because of course resistance to Israeli oppression needs to take various forms. But of course, for Palestinians, every single form of resistance is turned in, is demonized, is turned into an illegal act, and even something as peaceful as boycotting Israeli goods, or rather goods made in occupied Palestine, becomes something demonized and becomes illegal. So I think it just reinforces the idea that there are many influential and powerful lobby groups that will act and will use any means possible to pressure and destroy the Palestinian resistance movement. But of course, on the plus side, everything that they do actually reveals the heinous and demonic aspect of Israeli policies and Israeli supporters.
Okay. Well, let me get Blaine in on this. Blaine, your perspective. I mean, you're sitting in the U.S. in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And, of course, we know that in the majority of U.S. states right now, there have been attempts to make, participating in BDS illegal. How has it affected the BDS movement there? Or has it affected it?
Well, Marcia, first of all, I'm really glad you're back in action.
Second of all,
yes, the BDS movement in the U.S., I believe, has not been affected by these silly laws. And as the other guest rightly mentioned, in the United Kingdom, I don't think the BDS movement is going to be seriously affected by these stupid laws either. And the reason is because, in my opinion, what counts with this BDS movement is having people marching on the ground in their city councils, demanding action against Israel. And, you know, you don't have to demand boycott against Israel if for some reason they actually outlaw it, which I don't think they're going to do, but if they really do that, you can do what we do in our city council in Ann Arbor. I don't know if you can see the sign here.
Yes.
We hold this sign up at almost every city council meeting that we can get into that says we are against military aid to Israel. Now, how are you going to outlaw that? In the United States, it's impossible to outlaw that. In the Constitution, it says you can petition your government for the redress of grievances. And in the United Kingdom, I think similarly, they would not be able to outlaw someone going to the city council in London or Bristol or anywhere with a sign like this. It's impossible.
Okay.
So there's more than one way to skin a cat. You can demand boycott if it's legal. If somehow these idiots illegalize it, you can demand an end to military aid to Israel. Now, in the UK, you can demand no more military equipment to Israel because the UK sends a lot of military equipment to Israel. So these stupid laws are not going to stop anything. The one thing that will stop the BDS movement is BDS activists who imprison themselves in social media and who won't get to their city councils, won't go to their student governments, and won't publicly demand action against Israel. That's the only thing that can stop the BDS movement.
Okay. Well, Hafsa, your take on this. I mean, in general, what does it say about a country who tries to make it illegal? Because according to Blaine and yourself, you don't think that they can be effective in actually stopping this movement. But the fact that, for example, the United States and the United Kingdom seem to be actively trying to stop this, participants in the BDS, I mean, what does it say about the countries themselves?
Well, I think it says that they're completely beholden to Israeli interests. But can I just pick up on a point raised by
sure.
the other panelists? I would love to agree and say that it won't really have much impact, but I think it depends how the new laws are going to be worded. So if it's worded in the sense that it's a hate crime and it's racism, then in the UK, at the very least, there are risks for activists to be even imprisoned. Now, I think that the US laws actually on free speech are much more open, and I think that there is far greater freedom of speech in the US than in many European countries, where, for instance, you have laws that literally you can be imprisoned if you question certain aspects of the Second World War, if you question certain things about various, you know, even Armenian genocide in France, for instance. You know, if you don't abide by what the French have agreed, then you can actually be imprisoned for up to 5 years. So it really depends on how the politicians will word their policies, and that is actually quite alarming, because if they make it out to be a hate crime, then there are risks for Palestinian activists to be in prison should they promote BDS. Having said that, of course, in answer to your question, I think it really does reveal that these countries are very much sliding towards dictatorships, and we don't really need the BDS to be aware of that. I think the imprisonment of somebody like Julian Assange, for example, is an example of how much freedom of expression, of how much democracy are eroded in these countries who are lecturing other countries about things such as freedom of expression, such as human rights, and who actually, on their soil, are not applying it. We have seen that somebody like Julian Assange has literally been rotting away in prison for many, many years simply for revealing and for doing his job as a journalist and as a whistleblower, and he's been in prison. So imagine somebody who supports the Palestinian cause can face something similar. And I think that what is happening is these laws are being introduced precisely to scare activists and to make sure that they abstain from supporting the Palestinian cause. Of course, the upside of that is that people are also now more and more aware of the nature of Israeli policies, and therefore they're waking up, and therefore they're resisting it. So I think it's a sort of balance, but I do think it's actually rather worrying, in particular in European countries and in the UK.
Isn't it interesting that countries like the United Kingdom and the United States, that a citizen is freer to criticize their own countries than they are to criticize Israel? This is quite mind-boggling. Your take on that, what exactly does that mean? Okay, we've lost Blaine. I'll pose that same question to you, Hafsa, until hopefully we will reestablish that connection with Blaine. I mean, what do you make of it? It is rather bizarre that you can criticize your own country more and inside of that country than you can another entity.
Absolutely, and I think that we rightly saw, I think it was a Palestinian teacher who took the Texas to court because she wasn't allowed to practice the BDS. And so in the US, it's very bizarre that you can criticize your president, your government, various authorities, but it's considered illegal and hate crime or racism or whatever it is that the lawmaker seems to have come up with regarding Israel. And I think it really reveals what Donald Trump has said just last week in a recent interview, that actually Israel controls the US Congress. Now, what happens is that because Israeli lobbyists actually can pay, literally can pay a US congressman to be at their service, they have invested enough money to buy themselves each a US congressman, and therefore what this has resulted in is it is the Israeli government that actually controls the American powerful authority, which is the Congress. So in essence, through their money, they have these congressmen who, rather than work towards the benefit of the American people, for the American people, introducing laws that benefit the American people, they're actually working solely to benefit Israel and the Israeli government. And this is why, for instance, they will hesitate in introducing laws to provide decent health care, free education, and all those things that other governments take for granted. However, they will always vote in favor for large sums of money being devoted to the Israeli government and the Israeli war machine. And this is something that is very astonishing for many people outside who cannot understand how they vote for politicians who are more committed and more devoted to a foreign entity than to their very own people and population.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting what you've just said, Hafsa, because it would appear, I mean, when we're talking about, even talking about the possibility of this taking place in the UK next year, I would think that British citizens should be outraged at the possibility of although you said it's not going to have an effect, but even that the government would think that they could do this, which, of course, they have done or tried to do in many American states. Do you think that we would see some type of blowback from the British people in general? Because it's not really just talking about here the Palestinian cause of BDS. It's also the weeding away of their individual rights.
I think it's difficult because the UK culturally has a very apathetic population that very, very rarely takes to the street and imposes its will on governing authorities. It's been sort of conditioned to accept the rule of law and authority, and not, and very rarely question it. Remember, this is a monarchy, this isn't a republic, and it doesn't function in the way many old democracies function, whereby people take to the street to ask for their rights. They are literally conditioned to accept what the politicians often tell them, and it's very, very, very rare, in fact, to see protest, mass protest in the streets. And sadly, when you do see protests in the UK, they're often very demonized in the mainstream media, essentially, which is dominated by a right-wing press that considers that any street protest is some sort of savagery and is uncivilized behavior. And even when they do protest in large numbers, in any case, the authorities, for instance, completely ignore. So you'll have one major example, which I think many Britons who are listening tonight will remember, was the opposition to Iraq in 2000s, literally taking that war. Now, the only thing that Tony Blair did was appreciate that it was an expression of freedom of expression, of course, but in essence, it had absolutely no impact because it didn't change his mind, it didn't change his policy, despite the consequences and despite the opposition to that conflict. So, well, is that people seeing that their protests do not result in any meaningful action have literally simply abstained from reacting to any of these policies. And it's very sad. And of course, because there is a social condition that has been deteriorated, for instance, you're seeing the NHS, that the health service that isn't very well funded, you have schooling that is deteriorating, you have transport that is deteriorating, you have people that have far more pressing issues rather than actually take to the streets to require more rights.
Okay, stay with me, Hafsa. Blaine, hopefully we have a better connection. Can you hear me, Blaine?
Yes, Marzia, perfectly.
Okay, great. Blaine, I mean, on a regular basis, when we look at what's happening to the Palestinians being killed by the Israeli regime or being maimed or neighborhoods being taken over, their homes being bulldozed, crippling siege, of course, on Gaza. I mean, with all of this being said and everything that is happening, we always see that this is downplayed already in the corporate media, mainstream media. And now we see these governments trying to actually coerce their own citizens, basically to keep quiet, not to say anything. I mean, this seems like a total different level of going towards authoritarianism. I mean, I want your perspective on the direction that these so-called liberal democracies or countries are going into.
Well, Marcia, I guess I don't have too much time to complain about them. You and I have seen this for many years when it comes to Israel. And again, like I say, there's nothing to stop us from talking. Now, there is a good side to this attempted repression by the U.S.
Okay, we're seeing we've totally lost Ann Arbor and Blaine, unfortunately. Well, Hafsa, he was talking about that he thinks that it is having an impact, though. He made an interesting point that actually when the Zionists are making so much noise and there's so much attention and they're attempting to silence anyone or an entity, it does say something that it has them running scared and it's having an impact. Your take on all of this, the impact that you think that BDS has had on affecting the Israeli regime and what needs to happen from here?
I would agree. I have to say that, you know, if this didn't have any impact or if this didn't affect Israel in any way, then they wouldn't be investing so much effort in going after it, in lobbying so many governments to legislate against it. So there's clearly an effect. I don't think it's impacting, in essence, the Israeli economy as such, but I think it is having an effect on public bias that for many, many they've been fed a certain narrative on the Palestinians and on the Palestinian resistance movement, and they're now through something as very and peaceful as refusing to buy goods is being demonized. That is having an effect on public opinion, which realizes that in fact the baddies in this story are the Israelis, because of course for almost 50-60 years many people had been believed that the baddies were in fact the Palestinians, who were only resisting the occupation of their land. But now, because of all these efforts, so bizarrely, it's self-destructive for Israel in the long run, because they're showing their real faces and they're showing the nature of the regime by going after the most peaceful and the most innocuous form of resistance and of policy making. So I think that yes, this has a very positive impact on the long run. Sadly, in the short run, it's going back because it's going to deter many from embracing the Palestinian cause. It's going to scare many people away. But on the other hand, it will reveal the Israeli policy's actual nature. And I think that slowly but surely will actually start eroding the influence on Western governments and Western policymakers.
And on that note, I'd like to thank you, Hafsa Kara Mostafa, journalist and political analyst out of London, also lawyer and BDS campaigner Blaine Coleman out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. And my apologies for some technical difficulties during this spotlight, but we appreciate you all being with us. And make sure you join us right tomorrow for another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality, where we discuss various topics and then bring you back to reality. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us my main man, Brother Ja'far. Assalamu alaikum to you, brother.
Alaikum salam. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. We go way back. And we have Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Zainab.
Alaikum assalam.
Actually, we've never met before. So are you studying in the Hausa?
Yeah, I'm studying in Jamaat al-Zahra here.
Jamaat al-Zahra. And where are you from?
I'm from Indian administrated Kashmir.
Okay, Indian occupied Kashmir. Assantum. And Ja'far, where are you from, man?
So I was born and raised in Houston, Texas, mm-hmm. in the U.S. And after finishing my studies over there, I came to Qom to enter the Hausa and get Islamic studies as well.
All right, good. Thanks for keeping it brief. I wasn't asking for a life story. Okay, so I have a question for both of you, whichever one of you wants to dive into the discussion, inshallah. So the question is about, okay, this is really personal, but I want to know what you guys have to say about it. So sometimes when I pray on my own, like in my house, and I'm not distracted by anything around me, I'm really focused and attentive in my prayer. And I can really, you know, start to feel that khushu', that mm-hmm. kind of inner fear that we're supposed to feel for Allah. On the other hand, when I go to a masjid, I've got 1,000 things going on, you know, there's people on the left of you, on the right of you, behind you, somebody's coughing, somebody's sneezing, somebody's, reciting their prayers too loudly and you can hear them, somebody's grunting weirdly, and then it's just all so distracting. And I don't feel that same spiritual high. At the same time, it is highly, highly recommended that we pray our prayers in Jama'ah. So I see a little bit of a dilemma here, and I was wondering who could help me with this dilemma.
Okay, so you're saying your dilemma here is praying in a congregation is, in a sense, keeping you further away from God, in a sense where you're not fearing God as much compared to when pray on your own?
Oh, he kind of feels distracted.
Phone's on silent.
So, in one